So we're still here, Dominic. We haven't melted, despite this insane continent-wide heat wave that has hit Europe this week.
I kind of almost have melted.
You sound quite melty.
Yeah, although I did just jump in one of the canals, and it is the nicest thing to do in this city of Amsterdam that I live in. I'm speaking in Dutch sentence order.
The city that you live in?
Yeah, in this city, Amsterdam, in which I live.
The Dutch classes are going well.
Yeah, they are. And actually, I've started thinking in Dutch. And yesterday, I had my first dream in Dutch, which was really annoying because I have a very small vocabulary. So I think really stupidly in Dutch.
So what were you dreaming about?
Oh, probably about just being too hot because it was 33 degrees still at midnight last night. Sorry, I'm going all over the place, aren't I? I was talking about swimming.
Just put it down to our melted brains, listeners.
By the time this episode comes out, you will be sitting by a pool, relaxing, doing nothing. So you're going to be fine.
I know. I'm swapping a hot country for an even hotter country. This makes no sense. But yeah, I'm going on holiday tomorrow. It's very exciting. I'm going to Toscana.
Lovely.
Which is nice because I really need to escape this horrible city heat. I've got a great tip for you, a heat beating tip.
Go on.
Because you see a lot of these in the newspapers, right? And they're all quite boring. They're all like, take a wet towel to bed with you. But I haven't seen this one suggested. And that's because I have basically invented it. I found a hard-boiled egg in the fridge that I had previously cooked the day before. And it makes an amazing little cold compress. Just take an unpeeled hard-boiled egg straight from the fridge, rub it all over your face. It's extraordinarily refreshing.
That's a terrible idea.
Why?
I mean, firstly, what if it breaks? Secondly, the smell.
It's hard-boiled.
Yeah, but they can still crack.
Yeah, but if it does, it doesn't really smell that eggy. It's just like, it's a beautiful, pure little egg, no?
I'm glad I'm not there to smell your skin.
It smelled really nice. And just to stress again, unpeeled. It was just really nice. I thoroughly recommend it to you all.
Fine. Okay. Interesting. Well, with that, maybe we should move on and talk about what we're actually going to talk about this week.
Okay.
Yeah, we're going to head to Portugal to find out how they deal with drugs. In the 80s, Portugal had a huge drug problem, and like an alarmingly large amount of people had tried heroin, and there were quite a lot of people that were addicts. Nowadays, Portugal has a much better and more humanitarian approach to drug users because they, in 2001, became the first country to decriminalize possession and consumption of all illicit substances. And with this, things started to get rapidly better. We're going to be speaking to a social worker at an organization called Crescer, who are a group that, among other things, do important outreach work with drug users in Portugal. The Portuguese way is in stark contrast to the war on drugs model that so many other countries have gone with, and I found it a really inspiring thing to find out about. But we'll get to that after Good Week, Bad Week. Good week. Bad week. Who's had a bad week, Katie?
It has been a bad week for Pedro Sanchez, the Spanish Prime Minister, known to some as Mr. Handsome, although not to me. As you know, I think our politicians deserve much more than being constantly objectified.
So not true.
Guilty. But I'm not going to do it this week. I just thought I'd mention it in passing. Sanchez has had a bad week because he just lost a really important vote in Parliament on whether he can form a government or not. Basically, there are elections back in April, and Sanchez, who's the leader of the Socialists, he won those elections and he got the most seats. But he didn't win in the sense of actually getting a majority. He only got about a third of the seats despite coming up top. So, as so often happens in Europe, that meant that he had to start scrabbling around, talking to other parties, trying to get a coalition together. So Sanchez has been trying to team up with Podemos, who are a kind of anti-establishment left-wing party. He's been in talks with them for the past week or so, but they haven't managed to come up with a coalition deal that both sides are actually happy with. So Podemos ended up not supporting him in the two parliamentary votes this week on whether he should be able to form a government. The main reason that it hasn't worked out, and this is quite interesting to those of us out there who are kind of nerdy about coalition politics, the main reason it hasn't worked out is that Pablo Iglesias, who's the leader of Podemos, he's really pissed off because he says his party is just being offered like crappy B-grade ministerial jobs. So they wanted some properly big jobs. They want to run the environment ministry. They want to be in charge of employment. To which the socialists have replied, you guys are basically asking just to be able to run everything. And that's not fair because maybe we only want about a third of the seats in Parliament, but you guys have only got like 12%. So you should get an amount of jobs and a level of power within the government that reflects that. But that's where the power game gets pretty interesting, because as so often happens with this kind of coalition wrangling, you get kingmakers, right? You get these smaller parties that suddenly get to throw around an outside amount of power because the socialists really need Podemos in this government. And that's not just because they represent a fairly decent chunk of the seats, but it's also because several other parties in Catalonia and the Basque region, they had said, look, if you two can form a deal between yourselves, we will follow you and we will support this coalition.
Which I find quite a weird thing.
What, that the small parties would do that?
The idea is that the small parties would be like, if you guys can be friends, then we'll join you.
I kind of get it. Well, I'm talking about this just purely from the psychology of being really hot right now. I can imagine myself being in a situation where it's like, I can't be bothered to get involved with this, but if you two can just sort something out, I will go along with it.
I'm sure the analogy comparing it to your hotness is totally inaccurate. I think we should clarify that to listeners, and I'm sure there's a much better tactical reason.
That's definitely not what it's about. But yeah, it's been kind of interesting to watch this power game play out. So it hasn't worked out so far, which is partly Sanchez's fault because he only started having these talks like not much more than a week ago. But now we're on a tight timetable, which is going to make things quite interesting. Basically, he's got 2 months to come up with a solution, and maybe he will. Like, maybe they'll carry on talking with Podemos and they'll be able to give Podemos something that they will be happy with. If not, other parties could well come together and see if there's some combination of, like, right-wing parties that could have a majority could happen. Otherwise, we are heading for another election, which would be the fourth in 2 years, which is tiring.
It's too much. Say too much. That was the title of our first ever episode.
Was it our first ever one? God, it's crazy. I can't remember that anymore.
I have to go all the way back. No, second episode.
What was our first one?
Katie Smells the Money.
Oh, that's enticing. No wonder we didn't have more listeners back in the day. No wonder it was just like essentially both of our mums.
And very loyal they are too.
Thank you, mums. Who has had a good week?
The turtle dove has had a good week. And do you know what a turtle dove looks like, Katie?
I know what it sounds like from the Christmas song.
Of course you do. What?
Well, no, it's not actually. It's not like its tune, isn't it?
No.
But it's in the song. So no, I don't.
What I was going to say is you probably don't know what it looks like because they're doing pretty badly in the two countries that you go to, the UK and France. Oh. They are close to extinction in the UK, with experts saying that they could be gone completely by 2021. And in France and Spain, the numbers are dwindling. But as you say, even though you don't see them, you do know of them. And that might be because they show up in Shakespeare or the Bible, the 12 days of Christmas, most important in my opinion.
Yeah.
And of course, turtle dove is Cockney rhyming slang for love.
Oh.
Yeah. All right, turtle dove. Much of their decline has been due to farming. The birds depend on hedgerows when they come and live in Europe. It's just like the housing crisis, but for birds. But also some of it is down to hunting, and their numbers have fallen 62% in Europe since the 80s. They used to be really common in Northern Europe, but they have always been special as the only European dove that migrates from Central Africa to Northern Europe, crossing the Sahara.
Wow.
Quite a journey for these little doves. Oh, and apparently it purrs rather than sings. Maybe you can find us a bit of tape of a purring turtle dove, Katie?
Go on.
Anyway, the reason why we are giving them good week is because the European Commission have made a bold move and are moving towards legal action against France and Spain. They say that France and Spain have not done enough to protect these birds from the loss of their habitat. This letter probably would have also gone to the UK, but with all the Brexit uncertainty, I mean, B-word uncertainty, they decided not to get involved, not to bother.
Why is this not top priority?
Yeah, funny that. So France and Spain are, for starters, getting a stern telling off from Brussels, or a reasoned opinion, as they like to call it.
Is that what they call them?
Yeah.
Doesn't sound that scary, does it?
It doesn't, no. It warns them that they have breached the Wild Birds Conservation Directive, and this letter is actually the first step in something that could be a bit scary for them, a process that could potentially end up with fines being issued by the European Courts of Justice. Ariel Brunner, who is senior head of policy at BirdLife International, said to The Guardian that this was a groundbreaking step for the EU Commission, who are usually pretty careful about criticising anything to do with farming. So the European turtle dove has long been a symbol of love and devotion, and therefore we're very happy that the European Commission showed them some of that.
So in the Christmas song, when we talk about two turtle doves being the present,
yeah,
those are actually quite valuable Christmas presents because they're quite rare.
Yeah, although they weren't back in the day. Oh. Well, actually, no, they always have been quite prized and still are, and that's why they get hunted. I think the hunting takes place in Africa.
I'm just looking at them. They're really pretty.
They are gorgeous, aren't they?
Lovely wings.
Save our turtle doves.
So, as mentioned, we want to talk about drug policy this week, just what everyone needs in this weather, a nice meaty policy discussion. But these things are really important, and one of the things that makes life in Europe so interesting is that we have quite radically different policies on things within quite a small space. So lots of Europe, when it comes to drugs, still treats the consumption of drugs as a criminal offence. So I am currently sitting in London, and if you Google it quickly, you will see that in Britain, the mere possession of drugs is often punishable by like quite heavy prison sentences. So like in theory, if I'm caught with cocaine or heroin on me, just a small amount, I could face up to 7 years in jail just for like having it on me.
But in practice, that doesn't ever happen, does it?
Right. But still, what we have on paper is still kind of interesting in terms of like the signals that it sends about how society thinks about drugs. Portugal decided nearly two decades ago now to try something completely different. And yeah, as you said, they had like really massive problems with drug addiction, really high rates of heroin use, the highest rates of HIV in Europe, all of the social and health and crime problems that go with something like that. But in 2001, they decided to try this quite radical policy and they became the first country in the world to decriminalise possession and consumption. So drug trafficking was still illegal, but if you were caught with a small amount considered to be feasibly just for your own use, you might get a small fine or a warning or be asked to talk to social workers and doctors, but you would not be arrested. And it's been fairly well documented what happened next. It kind of worked. The opioid crisis stabilized. Numbers of people dying from drug overdoses went down. HIV rates went down. The crisis didn't disappear, but it did become more manageable.
I mean, would it still be described as a crisis?
Probably not, right? Not compared to what it was like in the 80s.
One place where it still is a crisis is in Scotland, where there was really sad news last week. Scotland, it's just been announced, has the highest drug death rate in the whole of the EU. Figures out earlier this month show that it's increased massively recently. 1,187 people died in 2018, which is up 27% on a year earlier. That is why we thought it was worth talking to someone in Portugal who knows about what happened there to find out what they're doing right and what other countries could do right. And we thought speaking to a social worker at Creche was a good idea. Creche is a non-profit that works with addicts, homeless people and other vulnerable people on the streets in Lisbon. Their goal is to help people get reintegrated back into communities. But what we're going to be speaking about today is specifically their program around drug addiction. We are going to be calling up Andrea Alves, who is a social worker at Creche, and she's going to be telling us a bit more.
Just explain to us, like, what does your work actually involve? Like, what does a typical day of work for you look like?
So, we have three outreach teams that goes every day to the places where people use drugs in the streets. So we make the change of the needles, medical support. We have the psychologists. If they need to go to the hospital, we go with them. We have cars to go with people that need to go to the hospital, all these kind of things. If they need a shelter to sleep, we can go with them and make all the connections that they need to improve their lives. We give them clean material to use drugs. That's it.
So back in 2001, drugs were decriminalized in Portugal to some extent. Does the fact that drugs, that you don't have to treat drug takers as criminals, make your job much easier, presumably?
Yeah. It's really different because it opens a lot of answers for people that use drugs, like the change of the needles in the streets, free treatment. These people need help and not to go to jail, or this is not a judicial problem. This is a social and a health problem.
I know that you're much too young to remember what the situation was like before 2001. Like, I know you weren't working back then. But can you just describe for us, like, the scale of the problem that Portugal had with drugs before the law changed in 2001?
We have one place called Casal Ventoso where hundreds of people go every day to use drugs. And a lot of them had HIV, living in tents or in the streets, sharing all the needles, and it was terrible.
I've also read that the change in law in 2001 was accompanied by a kind of cultural change in Portugal in the way that people see drugs and addiction. So people stopped using the word drogados, for example, to refer to junkies. And the language around addiction became more sympathetic. How important do you think that was in helping to reduce the drug crisis in Portugal?
I think it's important because when people recover, it's really important that they are accepted by the society. If you want to get a job, you need that someone gave a chance to you. And when you change these words, you can like change the perspective and the view that people have to the people that use drugs.
Critics of the policy in Portugal sometimes say that if you legalize drugs, you are signaling to society that they are socially acceptable and that that will ultimately encourage people to think that it is okay to take them, and that ultimately will make the problem worse. What do you say to people that argue that?
I think that people that use drugs will use anyway. The point is that when you legalize, you give to all the community more information. A lot of people don't know what they are using because we don't have like drug testing, so people can't know how much heroin they are buying when they buy a pack of heroin. The same with the cocaine, all the drugs. They don't know this, and so they can have like an overdose or have a lot of health problems. When you legalize, we give to the people the power to decide what they want to use. And also you give to the society a different view about what is a drug. In Portugal and countries in the world, alcohol is a legal drug. And not all the people use alcohol. You just use alcohol when you are like in a party. It's a choice. You can use it, but with information and knowing what you are using and having this power to choose.
You work on the ground with drug users, and I'm sure you find some of the government policies far from perfect. I was wondering, what improvements would you want to make to the existing policy to further reduce the amount of harm caused by drugs in society?
We are still waiting for naloxone. I don't know if you are familiar with naloxone. It's a substance that you can use to stop an overdose. We also are waiting for the drug consumption rooms. It's a place where people can use drugs with a nurse, doctor, social workers, and also peers, people that used in the past but are not using right now. In Lisbon, we have some streets where we can easily see needles in the ground. It's bad. And if we have a correct place for people to use drugs with support from a team, it was better for everyone, for the community, and also for people who use drugs. I visit three in different countries, Barcelona, Amsterdam, and Berlin. They are great answers for people who use drugs.
I was wondering, do you think that an organization like CreShare is always going to be necessary in society? Or do you imagine that at some point there could be some government policy or change in society that means that your outreach work isn't necessary anymore?
I think that the outreach work, it's always necessary because we will have people in the street, not just using, but also homeless people. I think it's really hard to resolve all the situation of homeless people. We also work with homeless people, but we can change the place that we work. It was better if we work in a drug consumption room than in the street. So maybe we can change our intervention and the place where we work, but there will always be people using drugs, so we will always be necessary. I think so.
Some countries have experimented with kind of Portugal-style policies to some extent, like particularly Netherlands and the Czech Republic. Lots of other countries haven't. Why do you think so many countries have preferred to carry on treating drug taking as a criminal activity?
I don't really know, because for me it's really clear, because the people start to get better, the HIV reduced, more people get to treatment, the number of overdoses are less than before. I know the people that are in the streets, and I know that it's better now than in the past. So I can't really understand why the governments of other people don't apply the same politics.
Just talking to Andrea, it kind of really hits home how differently most of Europe treats drugs as opposed to alcohol, right? Which is another really like damaging drug that can be seriously damaging when people get addicted to it. But loads of us just consume in like minor doses and deal with it in a much more manageable way.
It is a strange thing. We had exactly this debate in my Dutch class today.
Did you?
Yeah.
What can you say in Dutch about it?
Oh no, don't make me do that. I'm too tired. And also, if I'm honest, I've had a beer already because it was our final Dutch class.
Well, there you are. This just goes to show our differing attitudes towards drugs. Do you think it would be acceptable for me to do this podcast having taken a little bit of cocaine?
Yes.
Oh.
It would probably explain why you're talking so fast this week.
Sorry. We do get a lot of complaints about how quickly we talk on this podcast. Do you know what it is? It's just that I'm really hot. I've got all the windows shut for soundproofing reasons. And I'm actively trying to sound awake, which is making me talk really fast. So I'm going to slow it right down for happy ending. Except it's you that's doing the talking. What's the happy ending?
Well, in a week in which we've had a lot of focus on a certain floppy-haired Etonian with a questionable relationship with the truth entering number 10.
I wondered when he was going to come up.
Yeah, I imagine a lot of people need a happy ending, particularly our British Euro-minded listeners. So today I'm grateful to Anna Yorok for once again posting a great candidate for the happy ending on our Facebook Patreon supporters group. Thank you, Anne. She drew my attention to the fact that Xavier Bettel, the Prime Minister of Luxembourg, spent some hours doing something pretty lovely last week. Bettel took part in a scheme called Guide for One Day, in which Luxembourgers take 25 people around their favourite locations as a one-off tour guide. I know we could just see this as a really good PR stunt that makes him look nice, and he did just so happen to have a news crew with him and a photographer. But I can also decide to try and not be a total cynic and appreciate the nice thing it was for the 25 people that were there, I assume. Bettel first took his group around the newly renovated Hotel Saint-Maximin, the main seat of Luxembourg's government. He also took them to the parliament, the palace, and the city hall. And if I'm obvious, it sounds a bit like quite an obvious tour for the Prime Minister to do, but good on you, Xavier, for doing it. Next time, maybe come up with some slightly more original ideas. Take people to some, like, places that they might not have seen before.
Did you want him to do a more grimy kind of, like, street art tour of Luxembourg kind of thing?
Exactly. Or like, this is the way I used to walk to school, and this is the place I picked up an ice cream.
Such a weird stop.
An ice cream stop is never a controversial thing on a tour.
Yeah, it's true. That's very people-pleasing. Our sometimes Luxembourg correspondent Nina Lamparsky, I think, went to school with Luxembourg's Prime Minister.
Oh yeah, I heard that.
So she would probably know where his favourite ice cream stop is.
Maybe Nina Lamparsky should do the Xavier Bettel's childhood walking tour.
Why can't she do her own childhood?
It was your idea.
That's it for another week. I've got to go on holiday and have ice cream. You've just really put the ice cream idea into my brain. I'm going out right now to get a Calippo.
Enjoy that, Katie. For those of you who aren't on holiday and are going to be still like stuck in sweltering offices, or maybe it's going to cool down, I don't know. Why don't you follow us on the social medias if you don't already? We are on Twitter at Europeans Podcast. I nearly gave my own handle there.
We're actually not on Twitter at Europeans Podcast, Dominic. You should know this by now.
It's because I just nearly put my own one down. I was like, I actually also don't know what my own one is.
He got very distracted.
Oh, what are we? At Europeans Pod is Twitter, yeah?
Yeah. Where should we follow you? I'm intrigued now.
At D.A. Kramer.
Are you sure?
At Da Kramer.
Da Kramer. Cool. You can also follow us on Instagram if you like pictures, at Europeans Podcast. That one is Europeans Podcast. And we're on Facebook. Just type in the Europeans Podcast. You'll find us.
We'll be back next week speaking a wonderful universal language, Esperanto.
Oh, shit. Are you and I supposed to be like fluent by next week?
Yep. Yeah, get on it. Enjoy your holiday.
Great, can't wait. Bit of poolside language fun. Yes, we will be talking about Esperanto.
And it will be our last episode before we take a little break for a few weeks to work on some other things, also podcast related.
And also because it's August. We're Europeans, we've got to take August off. It's like the law, isn't it?
Yeah, I think some people take a bit more than August off, if you know what I'm saying.
Jean-Claude Juncker's off. I've just looked at his holiday plan. He's like put loads of deputies in. Maybe we should have done that.
Okay, send us an email if you want to be our deputy. And otherwise, see you all next week.
Europeanspodcast@gmail.com. See you next week, everyone. Bye.